With his focus on the bridge to the 21st century, President Clinton delivers his second inaugural address on January 20th, 1997.
My fellow citizens, at this last presidential inauguration of the 20th century, let us lift our eyes toward the challenges that await us in the next century. It is our great good fortune that time and chance have put us not only at the edge of a new century and a new millennium, but on the edge of a bright new prospect in human affairs, a moment that will define our course and our character for decades to come. We must keep our old democracy forever young. Guided by the ancient vision of a promised land, let us set our sights upon a land of new promise. The promise of America was born in the 18th century out of the bold conviction that we are all created equal. It was extended and preserved in the 19th century when our nation spread across the continent, saved the Union, and abolished the awful scourge of slavery. Then, in turmoil and triumph, that promise exploded onto the world stage to make this the American century. And what a century it has been. America became the world's mightiest industrial power, saved the world from tyranny in two world wars and a long Cold War, and time and again reached out across the globe to millions who, like us, long for the blessings of liberty. Along the way, Americans produced the great middle class and security in old age, built unrivaled centers of learning and open public schools to all, split the atom and explored the heavens, invented the computer and the microchip, and deepened the wellspring of justice by making a revolution in civil rights for African Americans and all minorities, and extending the circle of citizenship, opportunity, and dignity to women. Now, for the third time, a new century is upon us, and another time to choose. We began the 19th century with a choice to spread our nation from coast to coast. We began the 20th century with a choice to harness the Industrial Revolution to our values of free enterprise, conservation, and human decency. Those choices made all the difference. At the dawn of the 21st century, a free people must now choose to shape the forces of the information age and the global society, to unleash the limitless potential of all our people, and yes, to form a more perfect union. 34 years ago, the man whose life we celebrate today spoke to us down there at the other end of this mall in words that move the conscience of a nation. Like a prophet of old, he told of his dream that one day America would rise up and treat all its citizens as equals, before the law and in the heart. Martin Luther King's dream was the American dream. His quest is our quest, the ceaseless striving to live out our true creed. Our history has been built on such dreams and labors, and by our dreams and labors, we will redeem the promise of America in the 21st century. To that effort, I pledge all my strength and every power of my office. I ask the members of Congress here to join in that pledge. The American people return to office a president of one party and a Congress of another. Surely they did not do this to advance the politics of petty bickering and extreme partisanship they plainly deplore. No. They call all us instead to be repairers of the breach and to move on with America's mission. America demands and deserves big things from us. And nothing big ever came from being small. And so, my fellow Americans, we must be strong, for there is much to dare. The demands of our time are great, and they are different. Let us meet them with faith and courage, with patience and a grateful, happy heart. Let us shape the hope of this day into the noblest chapter in our history. Yes, let us build our bridge. A bridge wide enough and strong enough for every American to cross over to a blessed land of new promise. May those generations whose faces we cannot yet see, whose names we may never know, say of us here that we led our beloved land into a new century with the American dream alive for all her children. With the American promise of a more perfect union, a reality for all her people. With America's bright flame of freedom spreading throughout all the world. From the height of this place and the summit of this century, let us go forth. May God strengthen our hands for the good work ahead, and always, always bless our America.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Best Hope for a Sustainable Future on Earth. Alan Weissman shows how education, women's equality, and family planning can curb poverty, thirst, hunger, and environmental destruction. Alan makes a strong case for slowing global population growth as a prerequisite for achieving a sustainable future.
Let me explain a little bit. First I should mention, you know, it just seems so obvious when you think about this, and yet most environmental groups don't really like to touch this one at all. And the reason for that is really, it's really understandable, because this is a topic that makes us uncomfortable. It certainly makes me uncomfortable. Like every other organism, we were designed to make copies of ourselves. In fact, we were designed to make extra copies of ourselves because, sadly enough, most babies didn't make it to their fifth birthday. That pretty much happens throughout all nature. So the idea was, you know, your great-great-great-grandmother might have had eight or nine kids, but maybe two or three survived. Population grew very, very, very slowly through 99% of human history. The line was like this. Barely more than two babies per woman were surviving. But then, in the beginning of the 1800s, just before, a vaccination for smallpox, which used to knock us off by the millions, was invented. And that was followed by all these other vaccines and hygiene, all this understanding about antiseptics, pasteurization of milk, and then we started to rise. We passed a billion in 1815, and then we got up to a little over a billion and a half by 1900. And then two things happened in the 20th century that made the chart go like this. And this is what it looks like. I mean, this is the classic hockey stick. What happened was right before World War I, two German scientists discovered a way to pull nitrogen out of the air and slather it chemically on the ground. And this is probably the most significant invention in all of human history. Because until that happened, the amount of plant life on the planet was limited to what a relatively few number of plants without nitrogen-fixing bacteria in their roots, you know, could contribute to the soil. But now suddenly we could contribute limitless amounts of nitrogen. And we started being able to grow much more food. And that meant people weren't dying and they were having more babies. And population suddenly started to really rise. And then a lot of y'all remember in the late 1960s, a book called The Population Bomb came out, written by Paul and Ann Ehrlich. And population then was at 3.5 million. That's less than half of what it is today. The Ehrlichs predicted that the dire philosophy and prediction of Thomas Robert Malthus back just when that smallpox vaccine was coming out. You know, that population was going to outrace food production, that it was finally going to come true. We were even outstripping what we could do with nitrogen, which is so significant, by the way. 40% of us would not be here without artificial nitrogen. That's how important this stuff is. But they predicted that now, with the population growth spurt, huge famines were going to break out in the 1970s in Asia and Africa, unless an agricultural miracle took place. And unbeknownst to the Ehrlichs, one did take place, the Green Revolution. You've all heard of it. The Green Revolution basically created grains that would produce much more grain than per stalk than ever before, rice and wheat, corn. And then there was all this extra food, and it was tried out where the famines were supposed to be most dire, Pakistan and India, and the famines were averted. And everybody who believed that this was such a miracle said that Ehrlichs were wrong and Malthus was wrong. Everybody except for the head of the Green Revolution, Norman Borlaug, who won the Nobel Peace Prize because he's credited for saving more lives than any human being on Earth. And when he accepted that speech, instead of gloating over that, he said, "We've only bought time," because he understood the paradox of food. The more food you produce, the more people eat it. They don't die of starvation. They live to beget more people. And he spent the rest of his life on the board of population groups. As he said in that speech, unless enhanced food production and population control come together, we're going to be in a terrible situation. So would you like me to talk about India and Pakistan?
I was exactly going to ask that. You call it global water torture, some of the issues going on from some of the overgrowth.
Okay. Two of the countries I went to, of course, were India and Pakistan. India is, as a result of all these people surviving and begetting more people, is about to surpass China as the most populous nation on Earth during this coming decade. And let me explain Pakistan first. I'm going to come back to the Indian situation. Pakistan is one of the fastest growing countries on the planet, and it's just simply out of control as a result. It has close to 190 million people now. It's about the size of Texas. Texas has 26 million people, and the climate's around the same. By the middle of this century, Pakistan will have close to 400 million people. That's about 85 million more than the United States has today, and Pakistan will still be the size of Texas. It can't possibly, let alone feed, it can't possibly employ all these people. So you got all these angry, frustrated, unemployed, and underemployed young men. And guess what they become? And Pakistan's a nuclear power. This, to me, is pretty serious. In 1958, Dwight D. Eisenhower, former Allied commander who was then president, appointed one of his Allied generals to look at overpopulation. And, I mean, there weren't even 3 billion people on the planet yet. And Eisenhower then stated that the single biggest global security issue in the post-war era was going to be overpopulation. And the general he appointed to head that commission spent the rest of his life working on population issues. So this is serious business. India, we all hear these great stories about their economy. But I went up to the Punjab where the Green Revolution was tried out and was so miraculous. And I met with the head of the Green Revolution there, who explained to me that to grow all these crops really fast, they dug a lot of holes in the ground to hit water, which they hit then about 50, 75 feet. And then it went down to 100 and then 250 and around 500 feet when it got so expensive to drill and to pump, Indian farmers started committing suicide. And I spent a day in the Punjab talking mainly to widows of Green Revolution farmers who no longer can afford to keep drilling now below 1,000 feet to get to that rapidly depleting water. Since 1995, their farm union told me, and I corroborated this with the Indian government, 270,000 Green Revolution farmers have committed suicide in India. And they do it symbolically by drinking pesticide. So the numbers have grown, but water's diminishing. The use of chemicals to force feed the land to get more food for us. This is serious stuff, which is why I decided that I had to write this book. But in the midst of it all, I was watching, as all of us now watch, what's going on with the atmosphere and the climate. And I realized that, I've written a lot about, some of you read my book, Gaviotas, I've written a lot about renewable energy. And it's very, very encouraging, and we have to keep doing it. And it's frankly a sin that this university doesn't have solar collectors on every single rooftop.
Hear great speeches and interviews at Access Sacramento every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m. or go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
We'll be fighting in the streets with our children at our feet. In the morrows that they worship, we'll be gone. And the men who spurred us on, sitting judgment of our wrong, they decide, and the shotgun sings the song.
now back to The Best Hope for a Sustainable Future on Earth with Alan Weissman.
There are quite a few, just so you know. The parking garages, yeah, a lot.
If there's any hot water produced in this university that isn't from solar energy, which is really cheap to heat water, I stand by that sinful comment. Anyhow, nevertheless, the uptake on total renewable energy, it's not happening very quickly. 20% or 80% of our energy is coming out of fossil fuels. And even if tomorrow all we did was build solar plants and wind farms, etc., just the mining of the metals and the construction and all that would mean several more decades of carbon that we would have to work off before we had truly zero emission energy. So I don't know what to do about that, but I do know that there's something that we can do about limiting the number of demanders of that energy and emitters of that carbon dioxide. Because right now there's more up there than there has been in 3 million years. And 3 million years ago, the seas were 80 to 100 feet higher. This is going to do some interesting reconfiguration of our coastlines unless we start taking control of this.
Thank you. That's really important stuff. Now, you know, we've been hearing a lot of the problems, and we need to come back to those, but can you give us a little relief with some of the success stories you found? You went to places where women had been having 7 children or more, and were down to replacement rate, and Iran is a good, great example.
I'm pleased to say that I came out of this book more hopeful than when I went into it, because it turns out that unlike renewable energy, that we still don't know how to create it in massive enough quantities to run all of our cities and our industries and our vehicles and our Indias and our Chinas on it, contraception is something that we already know how to do. This doesn't require a technological leap. And many places on Earth are coming close to or actually below replacement rate. Replacement rate is simply two people have an average of 2 children, and therefore population doesn't grow. And if they have fewer, then population starts to reduce. Now, there are several examples in Countdown of countries that have done this without a coercive policy like China's. In fact, other than China's and a brief epoch of forced sterilizations in the mid-70s in India that brought down the government, all the ones in the book are non-coercive and voluntary. And one of my favorites is the one that Melanie mentions. In 1979, Iran had its Islamic Revolution. And immediately thereafter, they were invaded by Saddam Hussein, who wanted to grab this oil-rich province on their border. He figured this new government wasn't organized. This was going to be easy pickings. He also had the backing of NATO, which was not fond of the Iranian Revolution. And he had a lot of sophisticated weaponry from them, and even the fixings of nerve gas, which unfortunately some of our tax dollars provided. Iran just had people. So the Ayatollah Khomeini asked every fertile woman to do her patriotic duty and get pregnant to help build a 20 million man army to fight off the invaders. And at one point, they were near the biological limits for females in reproduction. It's probably the highest reproduction rate in the history of the planet. And they held Iraq to a stalemate for 8 years, and then there was a truce. But an economist who was the planning and budget director of Iran went to the supreme leader and said, "We have a problem. These kids are going to grow up 10, 15 years. Our economy is not going to be able to employ them all, in a sense, you know, another Pakistan." And the Ayatollah agreed that something should be done. He died. The new Ayatollah, who's currently the Ayatollah still, immediately issued a fatwa saying that there's nothing in the Quran that says, if, as he put it, if wisdom dictates that you've got the number of children that you can responsibly care for, there's nothing against using any form of birth control, all the way up to and including operations. Second, they made that stuff available throughout the country. There's a woman in the book, a wonderful OBGYN, a very devout Muslim woman who I talked to in Tehran, who told me about these horseback brigades that they would have, bringing surgical teams, and later by four-wheel drive and even helicopter, to the most remote corners of the country to make sure that everybody had access to contraception. And it was free, but it was voluntary. They had posters saying, you know, two is good, you know. But the only thing that was obligatory was premarital counseling for couples, which, frankly, this is not a bad idea for any of us. In those sessions, which were held either in the mosque or in a health center, among other things, they talked about how much it cost to raise, feed, educate, clothe children. And women didn't need to be told twice. But the fourth and probably most important part of this, they encourage girls to stay in school, because a woman who is studying tends to defer her childbearing until her studies are done. And then when she's done, she's got something interesting and useful to do, economically helpful. She wants to be a mother, but you can't do all that stuff if you got seven kids. So overwhelmingly, I found this everywhere I went, rich country, poor country, you get a girl through secondary school, and on the average worldwide, she's going to have two children or fewer. And if we were doing that from now on, you know, education's the best contraceptive of all. We wouldn't have a problem. We would be coming down within the next two, three generations to a sustainable number.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.